Well, I've got about an hour and a half on the Levitical system of sacrifice tonight. I think you're going to be really excited about, you know, huh? Huh? I'm going to shorten it down an hour and 20 minutes, so, you know. I was up early this morning and drove all the way up, so we're going to keep it short tonight. We got the whole weekend together. In fact, where's the clock? Is there a clock I can see from up here? Okay. No clock. They took down the clock. You used to have one right up there. Well, when you start fading, I'll know I should go. You know, somebody, I used to put a certs in my mouth and just think that, you know, when the certs was gone, so should I be. And then one night I put a button in there, and that was not good. So I want to tell you about a friend of mine. This is a dear friend of mine. Is in fact, you know of him without knowing of him. How many of you like Starbucks coffee? Oh, yeah. Huh? How many of you like Frappuccinos? Well, this guy invented the Frappuccino for Starbucks. And now you get these little packets of instant coffee. They're called Via. Have you tried them? They're fabulous. It's not like any instant coffee you've ever met. And it's called Via because my friend invented it, and his name is Valencia, and so they named it after him. He was a research scientist, a molecular biologist, doing medical research on cancer in Sacramento, California. But on the side, he'd go to his lab and work on coffee, you know, like after hours, you know. It was just kind of like his hobby, you know. Scientists, you know, my hobby is, you know, like watching TV. He's like inventing things. And so he's working on this stuff, and he's thinking, because he traveled, I thought if I could have some good coffee that was instant, not that horrible instant stuff, but something that's really, truly good. So he created this kind of concentrated thing, and it was micro ground, and this was like 20 years ago. And so he was visiting Seattle. He wasn't from Seattle, and his wife, you know how wives are, they're going, oh, you should take your invention over to the Starbucks, you know, the main store there and show it to them. And he's going, are you kidding? I mean, this is just, I dabble in this stuff, you know. Come on, you've got to do it. So they go to the number one store, Starbucks store, the mother load, you know, the mother ship where all the Starbucks people dock. And they go in there and he's kind of sheepish. His wife's going, oh, you've got to meet my husband. He's got a great invention for you. And, the baristas there kind of going, oh, man, here we go, another one. So, you know, he shows them his new concentrated instant coffee. And, you know, they're kind of being nice and smiling. Said, thank you, sir. It's really, we appreciate you dropping by. And, you know, so he leaves feeling like a complete idiot. I don't know, you know, did your wife ever do that to you? And he's walking out, and he gets about a block and a half away, and he remembers his ball cap. He left it at the Starbucks store. So he goes back, you know, forgetful scientist, and he goes back there. And now all the baristas are gathered around this stuff that he had just left them, and they're going, this is amazing. You know, we've never tasted anything like this. And he comes and says, anybody see my ball cap? You know, and they're all shocked, and so he takes off. He gets a call from Howard Schultz the next day, the founder of Starbucks. And Howard says, Don, I'm sending my jet down to pick you up tomorrow. I need to meet with you. So they meet, and he says, you know, we don't have a research division yet at Starbucks. I want to hire you from whatever you're doing, and you set up our whole research and development program. He's going, I'm like, I study cancer. You know? He's going, that's all right. You made a heck of, and by the way, I'd also like to buy the rights to this instant coffee you made. You'll notice that they're advertising. It's a little, not quite accurate. It says, we've been working on this for 15 years. Well, actually, it'd been on the shelf for 15 years. And the only thing they added to it was aroma. That was one thing Don said he never could quite get, and they finally, their people perfected that. He was an amazing guy. He had a heart of gold. He met Christ when he was about 42 years old. He was an atheist before that. And we called him, instead of Don Valencia, we'd call him Don Intensia. Because he was one of these CEO types, you know, just do everything. So when he gave his life to Jesus, it was, you know, he was just all about Jesus and all about Starbucks. And sometimes in that order, sometimes not. And he and I met about that time. I was speaking at a deal like this and met he and his wife, and we became fast friends and started traveling all over Latin America together. And he helped create a whole work in Latin America that helps the poor that I was very excited about. And we decided we were going to link up and be together for life and give our lives to serving Christ in Latin America and all wherever the Lord would lead us around the world. So I had a partner, and I'm traveling to Colombia. I'm on my way to Colombia, the country, and which a lot of people weren't visiting in those days for fun. And I get this emergency call from Don. I'm literally in the airport on my way to Colombia. I'm still in the States. And he says, "Bart, I need you to pray." I said, "What about?" He said, "They're rushing me to the hospital right now. I can't tell you the pain I'm under. A doctor has seen me. They said, just get to the hospital. We're literally on the way right now. I have no idea what's wrong with me, but I don't think it's good." So, of course, I get to Colombia. I call back. He says, "They've seen some kind of mass. In fact, it's so big that it's blocked some of their vision of my organs." He said, it doesn't look good. I said, "Don, I'll turn around right now." He said, "No, finish your trip, but let's stay in touch." By the time I got back, they had diagnosed it as some form of colon cancer, which actually turned out to be a misdiagnosis. It was cancer for sure. And so I flew right to Seattle to be with him. And I happened to get there the day they were getting the final and authoritative testing back. And his doctor called him that morning and said, "Don, can you come in today? I'd like to talk to you face to face." Not a good sign when a doctor says that. And he said, "Well, like, what time do you have an opening?" And there's a lady doctor. She said, "Whenever you get here, I'll have time." And he's going, that's not a good sign either. So he says, "I'll be there too." So he said, "Bart, I got to go visit a friend of mine who has brain cancer and is dying. I'm going to go visit him in the hospital. You take my wife," and two other friends had come as well, plus a few friends he had there. He had many, but a few were with us. He said, "I'll meet you at the doctor." So we go into this doctor's office somewhere in Seattle. I don't even know where. And she says, she walks into the room, and you can tell she's been crying already. I mean, her eyes are all puffy and red. And Don's there. And Don was always in charge of everything. And he said, "Bart, I want you to sit here. I want my wife to sit next to you. I want to sit here so I can see my wife. I want, you know." And so we just, okay. So a doctor comes in. And before the doctor can even start, Don says, "Doctor, obviously you don't have good news for me. And I understand that already. But I just want to tell you something before you even say anything. I just want to tell you, you're an amazing doctor. You've worked so hard to figure out what this is. You're obviously got to tell me some hard news. I can see it in your eyes. And I just want to thank you. You've been already amazing. Your knowledge, your care, your kindness. And whatever you can tell me, I'm ready for it. You know, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. I believe in Jesus. And so if I die, you know, I get nothing but more of him. And we're all people of faith here, so I just want you." Now, she's bawling, practically. I mean, tears are streaming. She's not sobbing, but tears are pouring out. So he says, "So just know that I know this is so hard on you to have to say whatever it is you have to say." And then he stops, and she says, "Don, there's no easy way to say this. You have absolutely the worst kind of cancer you can have. It's completely incurable. You may not even want to have chemo. You may want to think about quality of life, enjoying what time you've got left. And if you want chemo, we'll give it to you. You can change your mind partway through." Now, his wife starts sobbing at this time. I'm holding her. The other two, three guys that were with her, they start sobbing. I'm starting to cry. Only Don is not crying. He's just beaming. He's just sitting there looking at his wife. Well, 15 months later, he died. He was supposed to live 6 months. I think prayer
He's part of a Christ-centered community in Seattle that reaches out to inner city people. And I mean, he could have lived out in the suburbs in a fancy place. They moved down to the city near the university campus, which is actually a fairly rough area if you know Seattle. And so he had a community around him. He had people praying. Literally a neighbor, a good friend of mine, would go over every day and anoint him with oil and pray for him every day for 15 months. And it buoyed him because he had two teenage sons. He wanted to be around as long as he could. The day after his diagnosis, I met him like at 6 in the morning. You know, you woke up early. And he says, "Bart, come in here. I got to talk to you." And this is the day after he's been diagnosed with incurable cancer. He says, "I read Mark all night long, the Gospel of Mark." He said, "Bart, it's amazing." And he starts at chapter 1. He doesn't even have the Bible. And he starts at chapter 1. He goes through all gets up to chapter 10. And this is what happened in chapter 2. And this is what happened in chapter 4. And this is what happened in chapter 5. And he says, "Bart, everywhere they saw Jesus, you know what it says?" I said, I actually don't. He says, "It says they were astonished. They were overwhelmed. They were amazed." He says, "It says it 11 times in the Gospel of Mark. I counted them." The people who actually met the real Jesus universally exclaimed and said they were astonished. And then he says, and I love chapter 10, verse 32. I hate it when people do that to me. You know, like, I don't know every verse in the Bible. And he told me what it was. And he actually did a fascinating job of he was reading some version that just did a wonderful job of capturing this thought I'd never thought of. It said something like this. It said, "And Jesus set his face for Jerusalem, and his disciples were with him, and some of his disciples followed behind and were afraid, while others walked alongside and were astonished." Some followed behind and were afraid. Others walked alongside Jesus and were astonished. And then Don looked up at me and he said, "Bart, I've been following Jesus for about 10 years now, but I think I've been following from behind, kind of afraid." He said, "I don't have long probably unless God heals me, and I want to walk next to him and be astonished." Are you astonished by Jesus lately? Everybody who actually met him was. So if you're a follower of his and you're not astonished, it raises a kind of disturbing question. Because if the real Jesus, when he was on earth, astonished everyone who saw him, whether they liked him or didn't, he astonished them, he overwhelmed them, he surprised them, he blew their minds. If you're following Jesus and you haven't been astonished lately, you got to ask the question, are you following Jesus or a caricature of him? Now, I'm not talking about being astonished in some huge way. I'm talking about it in your own real life. Now, Jesus walked into the temple. I mean, wouldn't you think when Jesus walked into the temple, he'd have been reverent? I'm a Presbyterian. And we are reverent. Jesus walks into the temple of God in Jerusalem, and he astonishes everyone. Now, I'm a lifetime Presbyterian. I have a little certificate I found in my mom's records that says I was in Sunday school at 6 months old. I have a certificate. New Jersey Presbyterian, 6 month old. I've got it on my wall. And I went to Sunday school, and in those days we didn't have like PowerPoint. We had flannel graphs. You know, stick a little piece of, and Mrs. Jones was my Sunday school teacher, and she'd make a little cutout thing of Jesus with this flannel. She'd put it up there. And it was interesting because Jesus was always white. So I thought Jesus was white. I thought he was from the Midwest. And he always had a lamb around his shoulders, which I thought was very neat. And he always had kind of a little smile on his face. And children were around him. Everybody was happy. Mrs. Jones never put a
flannel graph of Jesus in the temple with a whip in his hands. It says Jesus walked into the temple and he was so angry at what he saw. You know, Jesus got angry. The veins in his neck were standing out. And he screamed, it says. And he made a whip of cords. He got a bunch of ropes and he put them together. And he started whipping the animals. And the animals that were getting ready for this massive slaughter were running and squealing and jumping. And then he took the tables, like if this was a table and they had all these nice things on it, he just dumped it over and things went flying. Money went flying everywhere. And he said, this is my Father's house. This is supposed to be a house of prayer for all the peoples on the planet. The ethnos, the ethnocene, all the people groups. Every single one of them were supposed to be prayed for here. And you've turned it into a den of thieves. And it says the people were blown away. And they said they remembered that scripture, the zeal of God's house consumes him. That's the Jesus we say we're following, who hates injustice and religious hypocrisy. One thing we're going to look at this weekend is if you want to follow Jesus and be religious, you're in trouble. Because he wasn't particularly religious. His teachings were about life. They were about anger. They were about lust. They were about lack of reconciliation within families and people groups. They were about justice for the poor. They were about bringing God and human beings, men and God, together. They were about how to move from a life of fear into a life of love, how to move from following behind afraid to following alongside astonished. And the people that flocked to him were the people that were so messed up. The religious people stood on the edges and critiqued him. The people that knew they were broken loved to be around him. I find that it's about the opposite of that nowadays with religious folks. I mean, I get paid to be religious, okay? And, you know, like when I'm on an airplane and they say, what do you do? I always say, oh, geez, do I have to tell them I'm a pastor? Because it really ends the conversation. So I say I'm an educator, which is true. And then it opens the conversation up. You see, people loved to be around Jesus because he exuded a joy and a purpose and a vision. He had a vision in life. Jesus didn't just wake up in the morning and kind of muddle through his life. He had a compelling vision. I read a book on D-Day. I was in Italy this summer with my wife, our 40th wedding anniversary. People say, how long? They'd ask Linda sometimes, how many years have you been married over the years? And she'd say, you know, earlier on, she'd say, oh, we've had, you know, 25 years of happy marriage. And they'd say, oh, that's really nice. And then she'd say, which isn't bad out of 32. And I, you know, I'd always be sitting there going, and then I think, yeah, that's about right, actually. You know, there wasn't all seven at once. It kind of spread out now here and there. So we're in Italy celebrating our 40th, which is a miracle. We've stayed married 40 years. He's very forgiving and patient, and we worked hard and got a lot of help. And so we've made it 40 years, and we love each other more than ever. And we're celebrating our 40th, so I've got some neat books to read. So, of course, she's reading books about contemplative prayer, and I'm reading about D-Day. You know, she's reading St. Ignatius of Loyola, and I'm reading about Dwight Eisenhower. And Dwight Eisenhower had this compelling vision for D-Day. His compelling vision was the liberation of all of Europe. See, that's what D-Day meant to him. D-Day didn't mean making it across the beaches. D-Day meant taking over, retaking Europe from the horror of Nazism. He had a compelling vision, and he thought about it day and night, and Omar Bradley put him in charge. Roosevelt had asked Bradley to lead it, and he said, no, Ike's your man. I need to stay here in Washington and protect him so he can get the job done. And you know what he did? The most logical place for D-Day to have happened was not at Normandy. If you know the geography of France, it was Calais. That's the shortest distance between England and France is Calais, the beaches of Calais. It was the most logical place. So the Germans were digging in around Calais and sort of digging in around Normandy. Rommel was in charge of their defenses, interestingly, who'd kind of fallen out of favor with Hitler at that time, but he was given that. So here's what Ike did. He said, I've got to convince the Germans we're coming at Calais. Because if they hit us on the beaches, this could be another Dunkirk. We could be annihilated. We've got to convince them we're coming here, and we've got to convince them we're coming at low tide. No, at high tide. Because they weren't coming here, they were coming here, and they weren't coming at low tide, they decided to come at high tide, which was just to surprise the Germans. So what did he do? Compelling vision. You won't believe this when I tell you. We've only found out years later as documents, secret documents came out. We had a counter-espionage deal with the Germans. We had our people planted over there, double agents. And you know what they did? They would find out things that we were doing and give the Germans some information about them just after they happened. You know, so the Germans couldn't quite get there in time, but wow, that was good information. But then once in a while, you actually had to give the Germans, the Nazis, you had to give them real information to convince them that these agents were real. So Eisenhower made the decision, painful decision, to give them true information on some of our bombing runs. And they were ready for our bombers. And many more of our bombers went down. But the Germans were convinced now that those people who gave them the information were giving them good information. So then those same people said, the invasion's coming at Calais. And they bought it. And it was a total surprise. It was such a surprise that 3 days after Normandy, all of Rommel's tanks were still up in Calais. Hitler wouldn't let him bring them down to the beaches. It was a miracle. But look at the cost. Some actual flyers of ours gave their lives unknowingly because their commander, Dwight Eisenhower, gave true information about their flights. Now, how could he do that? Almost feels immoral, save thousands and tens of thousands of lives. I'm not sure that would have been a comfort if I'd been the dad of one of those flyers. Why was it? How could he make a decision like that? Because he had a compelling vision. So you say, I assume since you're here, that you either are following Jesus or want to follow Jesus, or want to know more about should you follow Jesus. And I say, you got to have a compelling vision of him. You're not going to follow him very dramatically if you've got a flannel graph vision of Jesus. You need a vision like Don Valencia had. You need one that's up close and personal. You need one that breaks out the whip when you need a whip and breaks out compassion when you need compassion. So we're going to get a fresh look at Jesus this weekend. We're going to take a look at him from a bunch of new angles. And I'm going to be asking you the same question after each talk, in a sense. I'm going to be saying, do you have a compelling vision of following Jesus Christ? Because if you do, it'll be astonishing what happens in your marriage. It'll be astonishing what happens with your kids and your grandkids. It'll be astonishing what happens at work. It'll be astonishing what happens in the midst of your struggles, your problems, your temptations, your brokenness. Tomorrow night, we're going to look at what do we do with failure. Tomorrow morning, we're going to look at what is the centerpiece of God's vision in Jesus Christ. And Sunday morning, we're going to look at what does it mean to follow Jesus Christ together and not just alone. So I want to leave you with this question tonight. Are you following Jesus from behind and kind of afraid? Are you following Jesus Christ from behind and kind of bored? Are you following Jesus Christ from behind and you're so broken you don't even feel worthy to follow him or say you're following him? Well, he invites you to move up from behind and walk alongside and see him for who he really is. John said in a letter he wrote when he was an older man, a very old man actually, the last of the living apostles, he said, when you see Jesus as he really is, then you'll be who you're really supposed to be. When he appears and you see him as he is, then you'll know who you really are.
I want a taste of that in this life. I'm 61. I'm coming down to the last curve, you know, I don't know, 20 years, 12 years, 2 days. I don't know how long I got. I want to taste Jesus Christ. I want to know the real one, not the religious one. And I want him to permeate my life. However broken and pathetic it is, I want him to permeate it. So where are you? Behind him? Or next to him? Let's pray. Father, we need a compelling vision. Your son said, come, follow me. And then you'll see. We want to come. We want to follow. And we want to see. But we want that compelling vision he had. Nothing short of the liberation of the whole human family. Every man, woman, and child on planet Earth he wants liberated from every kind of bondage, every kind of brokenness, every kind of fear, every kind of worry, every kind of sin, every kind of addiction. He wants a total liberation, and he's willing to pay an incredible price to do it. We want in on that compelling vision, and we want to follow your compelling son. Forgive us for following from so far behind, so worried, so distracted, so afraid, so arrogant, so insecure, so undisciplined. Help us to move up closer. Help us to feel his love. Help us to feel his welcome. Open our minds this weekend. Open our hearts. Give us a fresh vision of Jesus that will astonish us.